The sermon today is entitled, Appearances Can Be Relieving. And we're going to discuss how special appearances can change our lives, change our perspective. And I think that you already know that that's true. I heard the story of a man who was working as a clerk at a grocery store. One night, just before closing, a man walks in, 6'9", huge, maybe 300 pounds, very big, very strong man. And he said to the clerk, "I need half a head of cabbage." Clerk looked a little puzzled. He said, "We don't sell half heads of cabbage." And the man said, "That's all I need." The clerk said, again, a little perturbed, "We don't sell half heads of cabbage." And the man looked very angry. He said, "I'm not leaving until I get a half a head of cabbage. That's all I want." So the clerk said, "Well, let me go talk to the manager." And he walks to the back of the store rather angrily, not realizing the entire way he walked to the back of the store, the big, strong man was only about 20 steps behind him the whole way back. So he burst into the back room, and the manager said, "What do you need?" He said, "Well, I've got some nut up here that wants half a head of cabbage." The manager's eyes got very big. The clerk kind of turned around and he said, "Oh, and this nice guy, he wants the other half." Isn't it amazing how appearances can change our perspective? I suspect that there have been times in your life where you were doing something that you didn't want to get caught doing. Somebody showed up, and the only thing that could come out of your mouth was, "I wasn't expecting you to be here." Or something happened, and you needed help immediately. And somebody showed up, and you said, "I am so glad you're here." You can think of times in high school when the big game was going to be played, and the star quarterback was hurt, and he, at the end of the game, limps onto the field at the last quarter of the game, and just his mere presence on the field inspires the entire team and they win the game. Or how that person you really cared about and you loved very much was gone, and when they came back, your heart just leapt because you missed them that much. Well, think about the disciples, and they're on the boat in the middle of a storm that is raging, and they see Jesus walking toward them on the water. Do you think their perspective changed? What went through the mind of Paul when he writes to Timothy and he says, "Do your best to come before winter"? The aged apostle is about to be killed. He's in a Roman jail. And his heart must have just leapt for joy when he heard Timothy's voice call to him through the bars. Appearances can be very relieving. And that's important for those of us who are trying to be Christians in a secular society to remember, because it is not easy to be a Christian in secular society. In fact, let's begin this morning with one apprehension. Write this down. Getting people to enter the church is easier than getting people to leave the world. If the call of Christ was just to boost a church attendance, then ministry wouldn't really be all that hard. It is easier to get people to receive Christ than it is to get people to become Christ. Even after people become Christians, they have to deal with that old nature. Wasn't that true with your life? It really was true of mine. Now, simply becoming a Christian did not eradicate all of the temptations and all of the desires to disobey. There are many new Christians who drag into the church the lifestyles they have learned from the world. They are still governed by attitudes, by attractions, by activities that they profess to have left. And that is exactly what Titus was dealing with on the island of Crete. Paul was writing to young Titus saying, "Titus, you have a bunch of Cretans who have become Christians, but they are acting more like Cretans than they are Christians." So the first 10 verses of the second chapter of Titus is told by Paul, Titus, get the older men together and tell them how to live with honor and respect. Get the older women together and teach them not to gossip or get drunk anymore. Teach the younger women to love their husbands, to be pure, not running around chasing after other men on the island. Teach the young men to look up and live godly lives. Now, you would think that you would not have to tell Christians to act like Christians, but we do. Because it is easier to get people to enter the church than it is to get them to leave the world. It is not easy to escape the world or the influence of secularism. Now, I've used that word a whole lot in this current series that we've been going through, so I thought maybe I should actually define it for you. So look up at the screen and write this down if you would like to. Secularism is a system of social ethics that is based upon a doctrine that ethical standards and conduct should be determined exclusively with reference to this present life and social well-being without reference to religion. Secularism says, forget all that pie in the sky, religious garbage. What matters is how quick can I make a buck? And how can I be instantly gratified in my bedroom? With secularism, all that matters is what will make me happy right now, maybe tomorrow. It influences us in so many ways, some almost comical. I came across a story from a paper called The Reporter in Lebanon, Indiana. A man named Sam Brown died. His widow came to the newspaper with his obituary. It was 4 pages long, all about his life. Well, the newspaper told Mrs. Brown that it would cost 25 cents per word. Well, that changed her mind. She said, well, in that case, just put Sam Brown died. Well, the newspaper said, well, an obituary has to have a minimum of 7 words. So she thought for a moment. She counted up on her fingers. She said, okay, then put this. Sam Brown died, Ford pickup for sale. Secularism says all that matters is this present life. And secularism influences us. And so we get sinners into the church, but we have trouble getting the world out of sinners. Des Moines is not much different than Crete. My job is the same job Titus had. Paul believed that even in secular societies, we could build islands of godliness. In fact, the main point of this letter is that Jesus Christ can work a profound moral change in the lives of people, that secularism can successfully be challenged, that you can get the world out of Christians. And one way we do this is to remember 2 very special appearances, relieving appearances that motivate us not just to enter the church, but to leave the world. Now, Paul tells us about those 2 appearances in Titus chapter 2. So read with me, starting in verse 11 of Titus 2, these words, page 966 on the Bibles in your chairs. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men. It teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, godly lives in this present age while we wait for the blessed hope, the glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good. These then are the things you should teach, encourage, and rebuke with all authority. Don't let anyone despise you. So what are the 2 appearances that help us battle secularism? Well, the first is the grace of God. And how did the grace of God appear? Not in a story, not in a song, but in the person of Jesus Christ, the grace of God, has appeared for two different reasons. First, to redeem. In fact, the text in the Greek literally says, the salvation-bringing grace of God has appeared. Jesus came to redeem. The angel told Joseph, name that boy Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. That word in our text, that word appeared, in Titus, it's a very important word. It means that salvation was not discovered by men as they pored over texts, or as they meditated, or as they brainstormed together. We did not discover a way to be saved, and then God stamps his approval on it. Grace appeared to us. We could not have thought this up. We could not have concocted this. We had no idea how we were actually going to get right with God. God appeared, and he brought us the answer. It is the word that's used to describe a cloudy day, and all of a sudden the cloud breaks and the sun just kind of shows up. It is something that only God can do. The grace of God appeared to redeem us. Salvation is wholly initiated by God. Grace showed up at Bethlehem to all men that they might be redeemed. When Paul says to all men, he doesn't mean that all men are going to be saved. What he means is that all men, regardless of how much money they make or where they live or what they speak or who they are, all men have the access to the salvation-bringing grace of God that has appeared. There is nothing that we ought to celebrate more than what I am describing to you right now. And as a side note, I really get annoyed with people that don't want to celebrate Christmas. I know we don't know the exact date Jesus was born, but I love to celebrate the fact that God's grace appeared to everyone. That is great news. But the grace of God didn't appear just to redeem. Grace doesn't appear just to transfer us into God's kingdom. It appeared to transform us into God's character. Yes, grace redeems, but secondly, also to reform. Now, don't change that order. The order is absolutely essential. Grace redeems and then reforms. If you change the order, what you come out with is the idea that, well, I need to reform myself so that I can be redeemed, but only after I have effectively reformed myself. That's not what the text says. Salvation is wholly dependent on God's goodness, not yours. Grace redeems, and then grace begins to reform. God has saved you not to live any way you please. Titus chapter 2, verse 14, again, says that he gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good. God has a purpose for his grace. It was to make you into his people that live his way. Grace is not going to permit you to do less than the will of God. It's going to teach you to say no to ungodliness, no to wickedness, and to say yes to being self-controlled, upright, godly in this present age. The grace that makes salvation possible is going to make the changes that are necessary. And one of the clearest examples of this in the Bible is in the 8th chapter of the book of John. They bring this woman who has been caught in the act of adultery to Jesus. Now, regardless of the extenuating circumstances that we've all heard, keep in mind, she was caught in the act of adultery. She is guilty before God. Well, after a little exchange with the Pharisees about who belonged in the rock-throwing business, everybody leaves. And Jesus says, "Woman, where are your accusers?" She says, "They've all gone." And note that Jesus says to her, he said, "Neither do I condemn you." That is unmitigated grace. A sinner received what she did not deserve. But then Jesus said to her, "Go now and leave your life of sin." Grace redeems, and then grace reforms. And that woman who had tasted grace for the very first time in her life had motivation to change her life and live more for God and less for self. That's what grace does. When the immensity of what God has done, who appeared in the form and flesh of Jesus of Nazareth, and he was put in a manger, he was hung on a cross, when that starts to penetrate our minds and our hearts, suddenly the things of this world lose their sense of excitement and glitter, and the things of God become more meaningful and rich. I read about a single mother who saved up to send her boy off to college. And she popped in a surprise visit about halfway through the first semester. To her dismay, the walls of his dorm room were covered with scantily clad women. She didn't know what to do. Well, she couldn't go visit him at Christmas. He didn't have the money to come home at Christmas. There just wasn't enough money, so she sent him a few presents in the mail. And one of the presents that she sent to him was a picture of Jesus that she had bought at a dime store. Well, her friend gave her some money for an airline ticket, and she got to see him again the next semester at springtime. And when she went to his room, all of those posters that were on his walls were off the wall. Just the picture of Jesus was hanging over his bed. Not wanting to be too obvious as a mom, she said, "Son, there's something about your room that just seems a little different than last time." And he said, "You know, Mom, when Jesus came into this room, all those other pictures seemed out of place." That's what Paul is saying. Grace has appeared. And when you invite Jesus into your heart, there are some things in your heart that just need to go. Have you ever flown into Chicago's O'Hare Airport? I have. And when you do, you take your life in your own hands. It's not usually a pleasant experience. But there's a neat story about the man that the airport is named after. His name was Edward Butch O'Hare, a World War II naval ace. He was the first naval aviator to ever be given the Congressional Medal of Honor. But you need to know the whole story. His father was known as Slick Eddie. Edward O'Hare Sr., he was the lawyer to Al Capone. His father laundered money for Al Capone, making Al Capone a wealthy man. Then he had a little boy that he named Butch. And he wanted Butch to have a chance to have a good name and to live on the right side of the law. So Slick Eddie went to the police and he turned in all of the documents and records that would indict Al Capone, knowing very well he would pay for that choice with his life. And he did. 2 weeks later, two shotgun blasts by the mob, Slick Eddie was dead. But his son, Butch, got a second chance. And because of his father's sacrifice, Annapolis accepted the boy, and the rest is history. Now, what Paul is trying to say is that the grace of God appeared, lived in your place, went to a cross, nails pierced his hands and his feet instead of yours. Why? So that you could just go back and live any way you want to live, the way that you used to live? Or so that you could have a new start, a new birth, live a new life? How do you say no to secularism? You remember the appearing of grace. But there is another appearing. One is of grace, one is of glory. The glory of God. Verse 13 in Titus chapter 2 says, "We wait for the blessed hope, the glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ." Hope in the Bible does not mean hope so. It means confident expectation. Jesus Christ has appeared in grace. Jesus Christ will appear in glory. His first appearance is an historical reality. His second is a prophetic certainty. In Scripture, prophecy is just as sure as history. Prophecy is just history that God has already seen, but we have not had a chance to see yet. That's all it is. Jesus Christ has appeared. Jesus Christ will appear. And that is God's story. History. His story. We're just waiting for the last chapter. God has already written it. He has an eternal plan, and that plan reveals to us that he is totally committed to all of us who are his very own. Paul writes in Colossians chapter 3, when Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Isn't that good? Jesus' second appearing is the next event on God's calendar. And people like me who are in ministry must be vigilant in reminding people like you about that fact. That's why the chapter closes with these very words. In verse 15, Paul tells Titus, "These then are the things that you should teach, encourage, and rebuke with all authority." Some people get nervous when ministers start talking about authority. Listen, Paul is not endorsing an autocratic church leadership, but Paul is saying that a minister of the gospel should say some things in such a way that you know what the truth is on the matter. I'm not to present the truth of the gospel of Christ in such a way that you think that it is an optional opinion that you can choose to reject as you please. The two things that I have talked about this day are true, and they have eternal consequences. Jesus Christ has appeared, and Jesus is appearing again. And I must challenge you to live your life like you believe those things are actually true. John writes in the third chapter of his letter, "Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure." See, what the Bible says is that grace and glory brought you out of the world. Grace and glory will help you help the world get out of you. Appearances can be relieving. And let me share with you three applications. Write these down. First, as God's own people, we preserve our identity. The only way the world is going to know that it is broken and that it needs saving is if it strikes up hard against an alternative approach to living. That's what you and I can model. Yes, we live in the present age, but we do not live like the present age. We do not live for the present age. We do not believe, grab all the gusto you can, for tomorrow you die. We don't believe that's the way to live. Yes, we believe in the appearing of Jesus. We believe he is appearing again, and that shapes life for us. We renounce the world. We renounced the world when we were baptized. When we were baptized, we made a conscious and public statement that our old life is dead and buried. That part of the world is not in us anymore. As Christians, we start every day saying no to the world. Now, let me be clear that that does not mean that Christians live dull lives, lives of inhibition, lives of restriction. I think a lot of people think that Christians just sit around bored, dull, living, drudgery-filled lives, and maybe 60, 70 years as we're putting up with that dullness, then we can go to heaven. That's not what Paul is saying. Grace educates us in the art of living. Jesus Christ came into this world to model a countercultural way of living that is meaningful and fulfilling. He said, "I came that you could have life and have it abundantly." I defy the idea that Christians live dull, joyless lives. Nobody in Polk County has more joy than I do, or has more peace than I have, or as much a reason to live as I do. We are a special people, a unique people. We don't need to make apologies for the lives that we've been given to live in Jesus Christ, because those are lives that are worth living. So we don't compromise with the world. And I challenge you, in just a little bit, you're going to go back into the secular world. I challenge you, preserve your identity. Be God's very own. You live the Jesus way, and don't give in to the world. Secondly, as God's own people, we pursue maturity. Paul reminds Titus that every Christian is in a continuing education program. If you're a Christian, you are perpetually enrolled in the school of grace, and school is open every day. You're learning every day. The curriculum never changes. How to be more Christ-like. We who are going to be like him when he appears are growing like him in this present age. And ideally, I think Paul would say that's what elders are to help us to do. An elder doesn't exist to monitor mediocrity and make grumblers happy. The task of leadership in God's church is to inspire people in view of Jesus' first and second coming to live for him, not for this world. Finally, as God's own people, we persevere, in view of eternity. Now, when I read about words like grace and salvation and redemption and hope and glory, it seems to me that those words are meaningless unless there is a great judgment day. For the next couple of minutes, I'm going to talk about something that we don't like to talk about, but I feel convicted by God that I need to talk about this. I want to talk about the word hell. Grace is a meaningless word if hell is not real. Salvation and redemption and hope are worthless words if there is not a judgment. People with citizenship in heaven imply a community destined for hell. The doctrine of hell was not developed by the fundamentalists or the Puritans or by church fathers or even the apostles. It was taught by Jesus. Let me tell you exactly what Jesus taught. Jesus taught that God made hell for the devil and his angels. That's who God prepared it for. It was not prepared for you or for me. Hell is for the devil and his angels. Therefore, if any person goes to hell, they go against God's intended destiny for them. In short, hell is man's choice, not God's. In this present age, you have a choice. If you choose secularism to be your guiding philosophy, if you choose selfishness more than godliness, if you care more about greed than grace, then on judgment day, God will honor your choice forever. Now, Jesus is coming again. And our task is singular: to be ready when he comes. A lot of us have made bad choices. Fact of the matter is, we can survive bad choices. But we cannot be wrong on this one. We have to choose whether or not to take the appearance and the coming appearance of Jesus seriously. He's coming again. I want you to look at the screen at this image. Most of us have seen this particular image. It's called, "Behold, I Stand at the Door and Knock." Jesus is outside the doorway of a home. He's knocking. The most interesting thing about this image, if you look carefully, there is no doorknob on the outside. Jesus has appeared. Jesus knocks. But only the person inside can let him in. Grace has appeared to all men, but Christ forces himself on no man. And we are here today to beg you to invite Jesus Christ into your heart. We're going to do that by singing a song of invitation.